Hey. Well, it doesn't get a whole lot better than that with a SG Supreme custom shop model and a Richard Goodsell Black Labrador, or in my case, a Chocolate Lab, since he was gracious enough to make me an amplifier with covered in brown ostrich leather instead of the traditional black. Yes, it's once again time for you know what. As promised, and I as a sort of warning to folks, this is going to be an extremely blunt and unflattering, scathing look at the so-called disease model and 12 steps. I've tried to be semi-polite about it in the past and hold my tongue about it because I know there's a lot of folks out there who buy that foolishness. And certainly to each his or her own, I don't care, but I just got such a belly full of that foolishness at one of the workshops I went to recently that I just can't stand it any longer. There was so much misinformation being given, which is so typical of these folks because they don't understand a tenth of what they think they understand, and yet they act like they know everything. But of course, that's part of the narcissism that is AA in the 12 steps. So, having had a belly full of that from the presenters and from some of the attendees who obviously, and no offense when I say this, have the intelligence of an aardvark in heat, I decided to do this podcast to once and for all put an end to this topic and frankly, to allow myself to pontificate endlessly on this topic. So, if any of you out there are staunch supporters of the 12 steps or the disease model, do yourself a favor and dump the podcast now because you're going to hate it. And that's okay. And if it works for you, more power to you. But it definitely doesn't work for me, and I'm done with it. So, here we go. For those of you who don't know, the 12-step model is based on a disease concept of addictions, and I'll give you the short version. It basically says that any and all addictions are due to a quote-unquote brain disease, and that basically, in order to get help for the brain disease, from which you are never, repeat, never cured, you have to engage in a spiritual quest. It involves attending a jillion AA meetings and giving up to God as you understand him or her, it or them or whatever, and yada, yada, yada. So it's really a travesty, in my personal opinion, but it was started by a back in the day. And I have to give folks credit in the initial inception because back in the day when this thing was started, back in the early 1900s, addicts were seen as being moral degenerates with no, intelligence slash people who are guilty of moral turpitude and horrible character structure and reprobates and yada, 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 which we know is ridiculous. But that's what a lot of folks believed back in the day. And as a result, a lot of folks in the medical profession and in the counseling profession wouldn't treat these folks because they felt they just were moral degenerates. What happened is there was basically a minister type guy and a physician who met each other and could not get sober and decided to form a fellowship of like-minded addicts who believed the way they did, which was they had a spiritual disease, biologically based brain disease, and that the only thing that could cure them basically was to get right with God. And I'm being a little facetious, but. And of course, what happened is they set up this camp, so to speak, based on these 12 principles, these 12 steps, which most of you probably know, but if you don't, I'm going to be going through them. And it quickly gained a lot of support, in my personal opinion, because Americans like people to blame for their stuff. They don't like taking responsibility for their shit, so we like to blame everybody else. I would also add, we're the only country that buys this crap. We're the primary prima facie nation that believes this disease model foolishness. And while there are splinter groups in a couple of other countries. By and large, 99% of the AA stuff is here in America. Most of the countries use a much more rational and sane approach to this. But I digress. So once this thing got set up, then to make matters even worse and to seal this model in the minds of the American public, there was a physician named Jelinek who decided to run a questionnaire to see if addictions really were disease, to test this sort of theory. So he devises this questionnaire, but there are many methodological flaws to his study, which, to his credit, in his original design and in his original paper said, you know, this thing is just a beginning point and it's fraught with all kinds of problems and folks need to take this and really look at it and test it out and yada yada, which of course nobody did. And here's the problems with the original study. It was only, first of all, the questionnaire was only sent to AA members to be filled out. And I don't remember the exact number of original questionnaires, but something like 300, 400 questionnaires got sent out. Many of them were not returned. By members' own admission, many AA members filled them in for their buddies and sent them in. So there was no, you know, controlled who filled what out, when, where, how, and why. So they got a bunch of these things back, probably, I think, something like 180 of these things back, 200 of them, whatever. And when Jelinek started analyzing the data, he figured, looking at the patterns, because they were, you know, coded for male and female, that several of the female patterns, responses in the profile, in fact, most of them, didn't match the male profiles. So he tossed all the female protocols. So what you now have is, you know, less than half of the original return protocols to him, around half, and they're all coming from male members, only from AA members. And he analyzes the results, and lo and behold, what do the results say? Oh my God, addictions are diseases. And then he further subtypes diseases, alcoholics, into the alpha type and the beta type and all that kind of stuff. And this is where all this crap comes from, okay? And of course, since a physician did it, it was like, oh my God, you know, it's from the mouth of God. We're going to praise Jesus. We're going to publish this and take it for gospel. And so now this gave everybody permission to treat addicts because, oh my God, they weren't morally bereft, which they aren't, and that was true. They have this disease. They can't help it. Oh my gosh. Okay. This is why we have the 12-step model today, and this is why it is so prevalent in the medical profession and the counseling profession, because most persons who get master's or doctorates in social work, counseling, psychiatry, or psychology don't really know doodle squat about addictions. And when I was coming up in grad school, there was almost no courses in addictions. And the program I went to had two classes in substance abuse and dependency, and that was considered like woohoo, you know, cutting edge back in the day. Now, of course, there are specialty tracks, but the problem is this disease model has so permeated the American mindset and the insurance mindset and the medical mindset that if you say this is heifer hockey, you get ousted and castigated very much like you're the, you know, redheaded stepchild that says, you know, God is dead, very much like you're an atheist or an agnostic, or, you know, you have sinned against the cult, quote unquote, and I use that word on purpose. And while I don't mishear me, I'm not calling it a cult, quote-unquote, although a lot of folks have. I do think it is a religious-based organization, at the very least, that has very dogmatic rules and is very cult-esque in its rules and guidelines and sanctions and shunnings and all this kind of stuff. Not in the traditional way that the Amish folks shun people, but you definitely get... as Geddy Lee would say in his song Subdivisions, and as Neil Peart writes, because he writes most of the lyrics to the Rush songs, in case you guys didn't know that, conform or be cast out, right? So, with that in mind, I'm going to start going through some stuff and let the readers, or listeners as it were, who aren't familiar with this, listen to some of this tripe that is just absolute foolishness, so, in my personal opinion. So to start with, let me talk about the so-called 12 steps and what they actually say. And I'm going to read them verbatim. Okay, so these are the 12 steps that every addict has to adhere to, and they work through the steps and yada, 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 right? And they act like this is some therapy technique. Well, this was never, repeat, N-E-V-E-R, never intended to be therapy. Ever, never, ever, never, ever. Even the original founders, you know, Bill and Bob, right? And I'm not kidding, that really is their name. Never intended this to be therapeutic. They intended it to be a spiritual and social fellowship of like-minded, like-thinking folks. And frankly, guys and gals out there, if folks used it as a social network for other folks to try to remain clean and sober, whatever their substance of choice might be, and used it, and they were very spiritually oriented, and they wanted to use it to God or Allah or Buddha or whatever, to help them and they're, you know, getting clean and sober and staying clean and sober, I'd have no problems with this organization. But the problem is it's incredibly, through the years, has been incredibly anti-academic, incredibly anti-therapy, and very much an us versus them, good old boy type. And I can say that for my, because I'm from the South, good old boy-esque organizations. You were one of us or you weren't. And you had to be one of us to order to understand us. You had to be an addict, you know, and there was all this fervor back in the 1970s about this. The same thing happened with the African-American population and the women's movement. Oh, you got to be a woman to do therapy with women, and you've got to be a black person to do therapy with blacks, and yada, yada, yada. And we already know from hundreds of research studies that is like tripe times 5 million, that the sex and the gender and the sexual orientation and the race and the ethnicity, yada, yada, have zero to do with treatment efficacy. None, zip, zero, the empty set. The only thing they do is engender a level of implied or assumed similarity between the patient and the therapist. And so in the early stages, it enhances this perceived notion of similarity and somewhat cooperation, but it is, I mean, that's as far as it goes, boys and girls. So this whole thing is tripe, and this whole thing with the addictions community is tripe also. Now, over the years, they have softened some of that, and they're becoming more open to this academia thing, but this is a really new last 15-year or so sort of wave, and still, you know, they want everybody to be, they really like folks to be, you know, quote unquote, friends of Bill W. And that's one of the founders. And, you know, fully entrenched in the 12 steps and be a quote unquote recovering addict yourself. Because remember, you can never be healed from this. You're never cured, praise Jesus. You're only in remission. Okay, that's the theory, right? And we don't have any other disorder. And the reason I say disorder, because if you see the word disease anywhere in the DSM, right? And the DSM is the Bible of Shrinkdom, the thing that lists all substance abuse and dependency disorders, right? And it's even written by the medical profession predominantly, right? If you see the word disease in there, I'll kiss any of your listeners' tushes four times, okay? It's never described as a disease ever, E-V-E-R, ever, never, ever. It's a disorder. And why am I making such a big deal about that? Because it ain't a disease, it never was a disease, it never will be disease, right? And we also know that. And so fast forward to the 1980s, the late 1980s, right? There was a famous Supreme Court case where an addict was refused treatment at a VA, which still uses, as far as I know to this day, the disease model in helping treat veterans who are addicted. He was like had something like 28, 29, whatever, previous admissions to the addictions ward, and they basically said, screw you, Charlie, we're not letting you in because you're not really serious. We're saving the bed for somebody who really wants help. And he says, oh, no, you can't prevent me from coming into your program because I'm an addict and I have a disease and I can't help it. And he actually sued them and went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, at which point the Supreme Court hired a group of researchers, not addictionology folks, not addictions counselors, not recovering addicts, not anti-12-step people, researchers, statisticians, boring, brilliant people, right? Kind of like myself, nerds, okay? I think it was out in Berkeley, California. I know it was somewhere in them California states. A group of researchers headed by Herbert Fingeret to tackle this very issue are addictions diseases. And they look at years of research data and treatment studies and, you know, the whole nine yards. And guess what they found? That's right. Addictions aren't diseases. They never have been diseases, never will be diseases. And they published their findings to the Supreme Court that, of course, then, you know, decided against the petitioner's case. And subsequently, Herbert Fingeret, I think it was in the late 1980s, 88, 89, or whatever, published his famous book, Heavy Drinking, The Myth of Alcoholism as a Disease. And all the data's in there. And I encourage every frickin' listener on the planet to go get a copy of that book. And if it's out of print, go find it in a used bookstore and buy it. It's the coolest thing since sliced bread. And as you can imagine, most of the AA people hate it, right? You can also look at any of the work, tons of work done by Marlatt, who is a Canadian, eh? Who ended up in Washington State and has published countless articles prior to his death a couple of years ago about the ridiculousness of the disease model and how it's not a disease. And, you know, so go look up Alan Marlatt and look up his stuff. It's really awesome. Likewise, the famous cognitive behavioral rational emotive behavior therapist Albert Ellis had the same feeling. And part of his objection to this is because he feels like the 12 steps are basically a religious type organization. And I don't disagree with him in that regard. And as most of you may or may not know, Albert Ellis is an atheist or was an atheist. He's also died in the early 90s. But, you know, that's a moot point as far as I'm concerned, because I'm not an atheist and I think the 12 steps is full of tripe. Okay. I'm much more, and so all of you know where my standing is. I'm much more akin to Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. And for those of you who don't know who that is, he's the predominant moving force behind Jethro Tull and the lead vocalist, flautist, and acoustic guitar player, and writes most of the stuff for them. And if many of you recall the recording of Aqualung, which is probably their most famous studio recording, the whole second side of that recording is basically a pro-God, anti-organized religion record. And if you have not listened to that, it is the bomb. It's one of my all-time favorite top 50 recordings of all times, and I completely agree with Mr. Anderson's position in that. You can also look up, there is a rational recovery site, which is sort of the alternative to AA and the 12-step support group sites. It's called Rational Recovery, and I will put that up as a posting on my podcast site. And there's a gentleman called Cliff Walker who has a recovery watch, who is also an atheist, but he's also right. And if you look at his research data, it's pretty, and articles, it's pretty freaking amazing. And he's got all kinds of stuff on there. I really advise people to look at that, and I'll put his website up there as well. And he's got a great article that he cites off this website by Jack Trimpe called Alcoholics Anonymous, Of course it's a cult. Now, again, I don't necessarily agree with that. That particular article was originally done in the May-June edition, 1997, in the Journal of Rational Recovery. And that's another article I advise everyone who's listening to this to read, because it really does a much better job of this than your ranting and raving yours truly can do. So I leave that for all of you and your discretion. So at this point, let me give you folks a look at the 12 steps, and then I'm going to give you my version of what I think the 12 steps really say, and my version of the 12 steps that I often use with my own folks. The other piece of tripe that I heard this weekend that has really torqued my agates was, and rightfully so, the folks who were doing the presentation did say that, you know, there was a group of folks who had comorbid emotional and psychological disorders which means they had emotional disorders on top of the substance abuse and or dependency disorders, but they quoted something like 25-30%. That's horse manure, and somebody, some dumbass in the audience went, "Oh yeah, oh, oh, that's right, I'll see that in my group too." Well, they can both kiss my posterior. That's BS, and if you look at the research data, it's real clear that that's BS. It's a whole lot higher than that, right? And I'll tell you the same thing I said to these people, and they kind of looked at me with this disbelieving look, right? But of course, if you believe in the disease model, people are born with this brain disease, right? Which is just, oh my Lord. Anybody who really believes that, please send me a shitload of money. I have a bridge in the Sahara I'll sell you real cheap, okay? And I know there's a lot of people who buy that tripe. It just amazes me. But at any rate, I tell people all the time, nobody comes out of the chute. They're not born an addict, right? People become addicts because they have one or more psychological conditions, or they're missing certain skill sets or emotional armor, if you will, resiliency, if you will, to buttress, as Will Shakespeare might say, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that most of us deal with like, oh, well, duh, on a daily basis, and addicts have a really hard time with that, and I'm going to talk about that later. In case you folks can't figure out, this is going to be a very lengthy, as Ian Anderson would say, a very lengthy piece. You gotta love that guy. He's awesome. So this is liable to go an hour and a half. So you guys that are in a hurry and you want to listen to this later, if that's cool, download it, listen later. But I want to get this issue over with. I get a little crap off my chest, and so everybody knows what the heck they're dealing with. Okay, so you know, nobody comes out of the chute an alcoholic. They become an alcoholic because they have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, they have some other anxiety stuff, they have ADHD, there's a high comorbidity between those two, and I'll talk about all that in a little bit. Depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, yeah, it's ridiculous to think somebody's born an addict and you're predestined, you know, geez, Manetti. You think you were some kind of like, you know, religious Calvinist or whatever, those folks said, oh, God knows who's going to go to heaven. Oh, my Lord. Ugh. Okay, so here's the 12 steps. Step one, and you hear people talk about doing step work, this is what they're talking about. They're not talking about learning Fred Astaire dance steps here, okay, or break dancing or hip-hop or rap or whatever, okay, or square dancing or whatever. Okay, step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Well, the second half is absolutely true, because you can't have any management if you're an addict, whether you're addicted to sugar or the 12 steps or any damn thing else. And as Alejandro Barchesi, the Italian psychiatrist who worked at the VA while I was there at the William Jennings Bryan Dorn Memorial Veterans Hospital in Columbia, South Carolina, once said of the people in the 12 steps in his Bela Lugosi-esque manner, "They tread one addiction for another." And he was absolutely correct. The addiction to narcissistic sense of self, we're special and only other addicts can understand us. You know, the 12 steps group. Oh, you're getting in the way of my sobriety. I can't celebrate our honeymoon. I can't celebrate our anniversary. I've got to go to another meeting. You know, 90 meetings, 90 days, yada, yada. And you guys think I'm kidding, and I'm not. Some of these places want you to go to 3 meetings a day. I mean, it's just beyond ludicrous. Okay, so step one, yeah, your life's become unmanageable. You were powerless over alcohol? Are you freaking kidding me? What? Alcohol grew arms and legs and choked you and said, drink me, drink me, drink me, drink me? You got to be kidding me. Okay, I mean, please. You know, as a buddy of mine in San Jose says jokingly, bitch, please, are you kidding? Right? We're going to anthropomorphize drugs that they have some kind of magical power over us? No, you gave up your power. And you guys have all heard me say, and you gals out there too, I don't mean to be sexist, just a generic term. You know, people who don't manage their lives give up their power. Nothing takes it away from them, they give it away. Okay? So if you're powerless over alcohol, alcohol didn't take it away from you, you gave it away. And if you learn to give it away, you can learn to get it back. This is ridiculous. You're not powerless. You're not a wussy. Okay. Step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Okay, now, I ask any of you out there who know anything about Rotter, who's a very famous psychology guy, anything about Rotter's work with ELOC, external locus of control. And you folks out there are probably going, what the hell is external locus of control? Well, locus of control basically is a psychological construct that says, where do I believe that the seat, location, locus of power or control of my life lies? Does it lie outside of me? Am I, you know, a victim of circumstance or fate? Or, you know, God or the state or my parents or the teachers, or it's a Monday or Tuesday or it's raining or whatever, right? That's called external locus of control. Or are you the opposite of that, which is called internal locus of control, ILOC, which are folks such as myself who have obsessive compulsive tendencies that tend to say, you know, I'm the captain or, you know, mistress of my own ship. I get to do, you know, I'm responsible for all my stuff, and you know, nobody outside is influencing me. I'm doing it myself, right? Now, as most of you may know, you know, America is a very independent type country, at least it is at this point, until certain politicians are trying to make us a socialist country. Oops, did I say that? But in all seriousness, you know, certain Asian countries are not internally based. They're more communal, external based. So I'm really talking about America, and that's the only place the 12 steps really flourishes anyway. So stick with me here, guys and gals. So if you look at the research on locus of control, it's pretty obvious that folks who are high in internal locus of control tend to be better self-managers. They tend to be higher in resiliency. You know, they yada, yada, yada. They have all kind of positive, you know, affirmations according, you know, attributed to them. Now, that's the good news, and folks hear me say this all the time. There's good news and bad news. The good news is you're a lot more successful if you take responsibility for your stuff. The bad news is if a child starves in Africa or some person gets kidnapped in Peru, you think you're somehow responsible, right? Because you're in control of everything, right? Yeah, right. Hey, so that's the bad news for all you ILOC folks, which include myself in that population, right? The ELOC people, on the other hand, take no responsibility for their stuff, so they're not going to die of heart attack or stress or ulcers, you know, like all us ILOC people are if we don't manage it, right? Now, the bad news is, of course, they don't take responsibility for anything, so it's always, why'd you do poorly on that test? Oh, it's the teacher's fault. It's a Monday. It's a Tuesday. Why are you suicidal? Well, because my girlfriend left me, because I got engaged, because I got the best sex I've ever had, because I got the worst sex out, you know, any excuse, right? Or as one of my friends I used to have as a kid used to say, to excuse yourself is to accuse yourself, and he was absolutely right. So we already know that ELOC is correlated in this country with negative good mental health. So here we are, the second part of the 12 steps reinforcing external locus of control. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves are going to restore us to sanity. Yeah, right. Okay. Well, that's like obviously bad. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Come on, guys. This is religious. Now, a lot of the 12 steps will say, oh, no, it can be the jar on the table. It's however you understand God. At the jar on the table, the tree growing outside. So they're trying to dilute the fact that this is predominantly a Judeo-Christian spiritual organization, okay? And they try to dilute it for folks who aren't into this stuff. But, you know, if you do that, I see a lot of, you know, Christian folks will say, okay, now you're subverting Christianity and subverting God, and that's heresy. And I've seen a lot of articles done by very devout Christians saying, okay, this is heretical stuff. I mean, are you kidding me? There's only one way to understand God. As Sammy Hagar might say, there's only one way to rock. And this ain't it, right? So these guys kind of undermine themselves by trying to say, well, no, you know, you can see God as, you know, however you want to see him or her or it or whatever. I'm like, okay. So, you know, my thing is, you know, you want to ask the superior force, the prime mover, that's Aristotle's name for God, and that's my personal preference to refer to God as the prime mover. That way it takes all the religious crap out of it. You know, I don't care how you see, if you have a supreme belief in a supreme being and you see that entities, he, she, it, whatever, I don't care, but and you want to use that as an assist to help you. You want to pray and have, you know, that help intervene in your life. Oh, yeah, no problem. You got to get off your butt and do some work. And see, we're back to that nasty four-letter word again, work, right? And most of my rational Christian counseling buddies tell me one of the things they use with their counselees is giving your prayer wings, which I just love, which basically says, get off your butt and help God out. God's busy. Give your prayers wings. Get off your butt and do that four-letter word work, and don't wait for God to do the stuff for you. Okay. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Okay, now we just spent a lot of time trying to debunk the moral turpitude issue, and we're going to put morality in this thing? This sounds like religion to me, and it sounds like a bad freaking idea. Oh yeah, I want to feel bad about myself. I want to look at all the crap I've done bad, right? Which is number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Yeah, we're going to talk about all the nasty shit we've done and feel real bad. Okay, what a great way to increase emotional upset and to get an addict to use again. Oh yeah, that's a real good idea. Number six. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. So you mean God can't produce a miracle and you can't be healed of your disease? Okay, this is not right. You say you want to believe in God and you want God to take this disease from you. You don't have the disease anymore. And yet you don't hear a single 12-step person, no, I still have the disease. I'm just in recovery. Well, I'm sorry. That means God's not doing his job, is he? Hello? This is like illogical as hell. Have you ever thought about that? No, of course you haven't. Number seven, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. Okay, here's another one. You're going to ask God to do your work for you? Again, helping you? Yeah, no problem. Do the work for you? Are you freaking kidding me? And then you're going to still say you have a disease? You got to be kidding me. Number eight, I'm not making this stuff up, guys. This is really in the quote-unquote big book, right? I swear to God, Jesus, Buddha, Satan, Allah, and any of the deity you want me to swear to, okay? Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Oh, my Lord, are you kidding me? Let's relive the past and get morose. Now, you want to go to somebody that's important in your life, that's still in your life, and you want to say, hey, you know what? I just want to apologize for all the crap I did to you. It was my, you know, my bad, and I'm really sorry. Or, hey, you know, I hope you can forgive me as a person, a Christian, whatever. You know, okay, but, oh, my Lord, are you kidding me? Let's make a list of all the bad stuff so we can feel even worse about ourselves. Great idea. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, wherever possible, excuse me, except when to do so would injure them or others. How about ourselves? Well, I guess that quote says others. Oh, my Lord. Let's look in the past, right? Great idea. Let's look behind us and like wallow in our shit. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Oh, yeah. Admit we're wrong, but not fix anything. Or how are we going to fix it? Well, we're going to pray and have this thing removed. You got to be freaking kidding me. Now, number 11. Oh, yeah, here we go. This answer to my question. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. I don't have a problem with that. As we understood him. Whoops, ding, 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 ding. Survey says, here we have a religious problem here. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Again, don't have a problem with that, but you can't say, oh, well, you know, God's really the lizard sitting in my cage. And I mean, please, people, are you kidding me? And number 12, had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Now, you want to be consistent in practicing principles? No problem. You want to proselytize? Does that not sound like religion to you? Okay, sorry, guys. That's a religion. Okay, so that's the 12 steps. You heard it here first. Some of you probably haven't heard it here first. Okay, so here's my version of the 12 steps, and this is what I call a satirically truthful 12 steps, because this is what they say to me. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives become unmanageable, because we like to have other people to blame for our situation. That's the truth, and don't want to accept responsibility. Came to believe a power greater than ourselves, i.e. the police who throw us in the drunk tank, could restore us to sanity, because we know that addicts usually have an external loss of control, and we like to act irresponsibly, and damn it, we're entitled to it. Yeah, entitlement is like their middle name. Are you kidding me? Does that sound like borderline to you? Let me think. Or some other cluster B? Made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him, since if we don't get better, we have someone else to blame for our condition. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves in order to see who we could blame for each and every one of our faults. Right? Our disease, our other people, whatever. Yes, the yes but game, the famous transactional analysis, Eric Byrne yes but game, right? Number five, admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Yeah, other people's actions toward us. Right? Oh, my parents were addicts. I couldn't help it. That's why I became an addict. Well, I got news for people who are listening to this podcast. Addictions run both sides of my family, okay? Both. Ask me, have I ever been drunk? No. Ask me, have I ever done any illicit drugs? No. Ask me, have I ever... I take that back. I lied. That's not true. I've used alcohol legally, but I don't have more than one or two drinks max at any time. I've never been drunk. Don't do any illicit type drugs. And even though cigarettes are not a drug, I'm allergic. I don't do those either. I do drink tea with theophylline in it on occasion. You folks have heard me say that before. And I do drink coffee that has caffeine in it. And let's face it, guys, those are drugs. And I tell everybody on the planet, pharmacologically speaking, water is a drug. It has a pharmacological impact on the biological and neurological substrate of your brain. It's therefore a drug. So let's talk about good drugs and bad drugs in general, okay? But for the sake of this podcast, we're talking about drugs, what most people consider drugs and alcohol, right? Never been drunk, never used any illicit drug, never abused any prescription drug, never used any prescription drug other than prescribed by a physician in the manner prescribed by the physician, okay? So why am I not an addict? Both sides of my family are addicts, right? One side's alcoholics and cluster B personality disorders. The other side are iatrogenic, that means physician-oriented prescription drugs, gamblers and womanizers. How come I don't do any of that either? Let me think. Because I made a choice. I made a choice not to even go there, right? And everybody has choice. I claimed my personal power and said I'm not doing that shit. Because you know what? Does the propensity, the increased risk of developing addictive disorders run in families? Oh, absolutely. Does it mean you have to do it? No. Big difference in predisposition and predetermination, right? Big difference. And for those of you who don't know, predetermined means it's going to happen. Nothing you can do to avoid it, right? If you're born with ADHD, right, depending on how bad the ADHD is, you're going to have some semblance of that. That's a predetermination once you have it, right? Depression, if it runs in your family, it's not predetermined. There's a chance for you to get it. There's a chance not. And actually, the chance of getting ADHD is a predisposition. It's not a predetermination. Okay. So admitted to God. Oh, I said that already. Sorry. We're entirely ready to have God and anybody else who wants to remove all these defects of character while we sit on our complacency waiting to be healed. Right? What's the biggest drug addiction that just about every AA person has, right? Coffee and cigarettes. You don't believe me, go to a 12-step meeting. It's only been in the last 10 or 12 or 15 years that they've had smokeless meetings, right? What's the drug that kills more people every year than all of the drugs, including alcohol, combined times three? Da 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 da. Final Jeopardy music, right? And the answer is, that's right, cigarettes. What's the biggest drug that most addicts use? Cigarettes, right? And all the times I've been treating people with substance dependency and severe abuse problems, I've had four people, and I can't tell you how many thousands of people I've seen over the years because I've done both inpatient and outpatient, four who didn't smoke cigarettes. Four, okay? You're still using cigarettes. You're killing yourself. You're using the most dangerous drug in America. Put the chip back. You're not drug-free. Don't even go there. But they don't want to talk about that. They don't, oh, that's not wrong. Never seen anybody hoard themselves out for a cigarette like I have cocaine. Yeah, but I never seen anybody get cancer from cocaine either. What's your point? Hello, McFly. Oh, God. Did I mention I hate stupid people? Anyway, humbly asked him and anyone else who wants to help to remove our shortcomings and fast because we're feeling the need to use again and we're out of money. Number 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. After, of course, they admit that it was really their fault in the first place for messing us up. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would get us to admit that we are really completely responsible for everything we did and our condition. Number 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Except that our narcissism allows us never to be wrong, or we use the yes but game, well, yeah, we might be wrong, but you shouldn't have done that, so we never have to really admit it or do anything about it. number 11, sought through prayer, meditation, and mind-altering substances, since they increase our cosmic consciousness, to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us, the power to carry that out, and the money and knowledge of where and how to get more potent substances to allow us even more cosmic consciousness. Oh, well, man. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, or in all likelihood, simply a drug-induced psychosis, we try to carry this message in all our specialness, since we have deluded ourselves in believing that we have been chosen by God and that nobody else can possibly help or understand us, to other addicts and anyone else who would listen. And since misery loves company, to practice these principles in all our affairs, just as any other severely personality disorder person does. Can you say narcissistic or borderline? I knew you could. Okay, and that's my version of what the 12 steps really say. Now, what I've done for folks who just really like 12 steps and want to follow a 12-step model, here's what I've done. These are my 12 steps, and I call them a responsible 12 steps, right? Number one, admitted we have abrogated our own personal power over substances, that our lives had become unmanageable by our own self-defeating and mistaken life choices, because, honey, that's true. Number two, came to believe that only we, in conjunction with an appropriately trained mental health professional through hard work and self-modification, could restore our lives to a state of self-enhancement. Now, a lot of people don't need a mental health professional to do it, but most people do. Very particularly the guys and gals that I see, because they have too much on their plate with comorbid disorders to do it on their own. A lot of folks can do it on their own if they don't have a boatload of other stuff and if they have a really good social support system and all that stuff. And that's real important, right? And I'm not poo-pooing any of that. And as I said, if folks were to use this stuff as a social and spiritual support system, and that's all they did, and they went and got counseling and they did all this other stuff and stopped trying to do this, you know, kumbaya stuff, I'd have no problem with AA or the 12 steps or CA or anything else. Number three, made a decision to not look for others to be responsible for us, but to take utter and complete responsibility for our lives, both now and in the past, when we were under the influence of substances of our own choosing. Made an accurate and, turn the page too fast, objective inventory of our thoughts, feelings, and actions that have resulted in us becoming self-defeating, asking the mental health professional to assist us in our quest to rid ourselves of these self-destructive tendencies. Number five, admitted to ourselves and the mental health professional the exact nature of our poor choices and life mistakes, resolving to make new and more self-enhancing choices from now on. Doesn't this sound a lot more positive and a lot more proactive? I'll tell you the same thing that Boston's song says, don't look back. Song by the same title, right? Great advice, don't look back. Or as one of my uncles on my father's side of the family so colorfully put it, and this is a direct quote, so excuse me for sounding crude, there's nothing behind you but your ass and it smells, right? And what that means is, don't look in the past, there's nothing there for you. Number six, we're entirely ready to work to the best of our abilities. There's that nasty four-letter word again. Why does he keep saying that? Oh, my God. To eradicate all these poor choices and self-defeating tendencies together with the assistance of the mental health professional. Made a list of the steps we took to make self-enhancing life choices in the past so that we may apply these same steps or similar steps to remediate our present mistakes and enhance current and future potentials. Made a list of the steps we took to make past self-defeating life choices so we don't have to repeat these mistakes either now or again in the future. Right? Proactive stuff. If you're going to look back in the past, I tell every one of my guys and gals this, look like Inspector Clouseau, but a lot smarter than Inspector Clouseau. Look more like Inspector Sherlock Holmes, right? Look at, or take what I call the archaeologist approach, right? So if an archaeologist goes into, is doing Egyptian tomb stuff and looking at past, you know, great civilizations that are no longer extant, right? Excuse me. The archaeologist and historian doesn't go into the tomb and go, those stupid goddamn Egyptians, why the hell aren't they around anymore? They're just a bunch of goddamn dumbasses. No, they're inquisitive. I wonder why these folks aren't here anymore. I wonder what happened. They're no longer with us. I wonder if there are any lessons we can take and learn to apply to our current culture so we don't have to make the same mistakes as they did. Look at the great things they accomplished despite those mistakes. Right? Take the archaeologist approach, not the critical parent, the transactional analysis, Eric Byrne, the critical apparent approach, right? Or school marm approach. When appropriate, took steps to inform significant other persons of our new outlook so that they might not mistake our actions or encourage old self-defeating behaviors, feelings, or thinking patterns, right? A lot of times, you know, if people change, folks are like, oh yeah, sure you have. And so they expect you to make the same stuff you've been doing. It's like I tell a lot of my teenagers I work with, okay, so you have a history of lying. How many years have you been lying to your parents about stuff, right? 1 year, 2 years? So now you're telling your parents the truth. How long have you been telling your parents the truth? Oh, a month. Oh, come on, dude. You really expect them to believe you? Let's see. Lying for 2 years, telling the truth for a month. What's wrong with this picture, right? Of course, what you have is you've taught them, because your parents aren't idiots, you have taught them that you can't be trusted. Now you got to retrain them and teach them that you can, which means you got to put up with the monster that you've created, which is they don't believe you, until at least 6 or 8 months go by with no lying, no deception, no nothing. And then they're like, wow, this guy really has changed. Maybe I can start believing him again, right? Well, addiction behavior is no different. It's a mistaken behavior. If you've done it a lot, you can't expect people to go, oh my Lord, he has been healed, right? They're going to not trust you, right? Help them out. Help them to see the new you. Talk to them about why you're doing stuff and what your motivation is. Educate them. Get support. Support's really important and it's really, really cool, right? Continue to consult with the mental health professional when appropriate and only until we felt able to carry on without his or her assistance. And apply ourselves so that we may continue to be self-introspective and aware of our own self-enhancing and self-defeating tendencies so as to maximize our potentials and self-awareness and minimize our negative aspects. Right? Growing. Learning. Working. God, there's that four-letter word again. Oh my gosh, was this guy going to ever shut up? Sought to live a genuine, self-responsible, self-enhanced life, and congruously, persistently, and consistently role model our beliefs to the best of our abilities, right? You want to be a lighthouse to other people, you don't have to get on a pulpit and start preaching. Just be the light that you want other people to see and that you want other people to follow. You don't even have to tell them you're doing it. They'll get it. Honestly, they will get it. And number 12, having realized the aforementioned points, we practice these principles in as many of our affairs as possible, and when appropriate or when asked, help others to do likewise. So you're not proselytizing, you're giving people assistance if and when they ask for it. Otherwise, you're doing your thing, and that's the end of the story. All right. So generally speaking, let's talk about some of the common tendencies that I see with my folks. Right. Most addictions people I see have several comorbid disorders. Most commonly ADHD. ADHD and addictions are highly correlated. I think I've said, and if you look in my ADHD with SUD, substance use disorders, PDF file that should be up on my site by now, which is an outline of the talk I did at the conference. If you're an ADHD male, we don't have enough data for females. If you're an ADHD male, right, you have a 63% chance, roughly, of having either oppositional defiant or conduct disorder. And if you're an ODD or CD, ADHD male, which I love all these little acronyms, you have like a 90%+ chance of developing multiple substance and abuse dependency disorders, right? And if you do that early enough, you muck up your brain's wiring during critical developmental eras, which means you're probably going to have learning problems, you might have depression, anxiety, you know, personality disorders, whatever. Welcome to 85% of my caseload, both adult and teenager. Okay. So otherwise, what are some characteristics, just personality traits, that most addictions folks that I see, regardless of age, have? Now, they don't have every single one of these, but they have a preponderance of them. A lot of the substance use disorders, the SUDs folks, are conflicted over being autonomous individuals or dependent persons. You know, how much do I depend on myself? How much do I depend on society and other people? They are definitely ELOC, right? External locus of control. We talked about that already. They're definitely impulsive. They're definitely self-centered, egocentric. Some of them are downright narcissistic. They have full-blown narcissistic personality disorder. They typically are immature, and I don't say that to slam them. I say that as in a developmental sense, right? Their immaturity. Is developmental, not, oh, you're just acting immature. I don't mean it in a castigatory manner at all. And by the way, these are descriptions. I am not slamming a single person. And if anybody is hearing this as a slam, you are mishearing me. I don't slam people in my office because, like I've been slamming the 12 steps, and those are definitely slams. And if you heard that, you heard it right. I don't slam folks in my office because I don't like to be slammed, and therefore I don't slam folks coming in. And by the way, you're probably going, well, gee, what happens if these people are already in a 12-step organization and for whatever reason they're doing pretty well with it? Well, it's pretty dumb for me to start poo-pooing the 12 steps if they're attending it and they're getting something out of it. Now, I don't ever, and I mean never ever, send anybody to a 12-step group. But if they're already in a 12-step group coming to me, I don't poo-poo it because that's usually counter-therapeutic. If they're with me long enough, they'll see the fallacies in that on their own. I don't have to convince them of it. When they get clean and they get sober or more sober and more clean and their head clears, they see it. I don't have to point it out to them. They typically have a low tolerance for any kind of what I classify as quote-unquote negative emotions. So if they get depressed or sad, or dysthymic, or angry, or anxious, or stressed out, or frustrated, or they don't get immediate gratification, they typically get all, you know, like principal on Beavis and Butthead, ooh, Beavis and Butthead, oh, you know, and they just have to go run use because they're trying to, you know, better living through chemistry. They want immediate gratification, right? Most SUDS people are high sensation seekers. They like a lot of sensation. They seem to crave it and need it. And part of that's because many of them have deficient dopamine systems. And what most drugs do is they either increase the dopamine system in the person's brain so they can now start to feel pleasure because part of dopamine's role is a pleasure-seeking device. Or they inhibit an inhibitory neurochemical that normally inhibits dopamine. And if you're inhibiting the inhibitor, then that means you're increasing dopamine by secondary action, right, indirectly. So most drugs of abuse... substances of abuse, even if it's sugar, right? And yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not just talking about drugs. I'm talking about sugar too, because most SUD folks, like ADHD people, are sugar freaks, right? They either suppressor neurochemicals that normally suppress dopamine levels, which means they're increasing dopamine, or they increase dopamine directly. They have ambiguity over and conflicts between social expectations, peer group expectations, and familial things in the family. A lot of the folks I see come from single parent, blended families, broken families, abusive families, or otherwise somehow quote unquote dysfunctional. And again, I'm not slamming anybody, I'm just describing patterns here. Right? They typically have a history of problems in the area of childhood adjustment or development, social and interpersonal relationships, or work and or school. Right? They typically, as I mentioned earlier, have a plethora of coexisting polymorbid psychopathology. They're not comorbid, they're polymorbid. They have a bunch of other stuff going on. They often have very few or no appropriate role models, or they have conflicting role models that display conflicting or confusing behavior. They often are in a situation where they have environmental reinforcers for substance use or abuse, or at the very least, they don't have little to no reinforcement for non-use. Okay, so they either hang out a lot with a lot of other addictions folks or addicts types or abuse folks, and they're not hanging out with nerds like myself because I'm no fun. I'm a boring guy, right? Or sometimes their parents give them conflicting messages. And again, I don't want parents to hear this. I'm not blaming parents. I'm stating reality here, okay? They often have very low self-efficacy. They really don't, and we've talked about that term before, and self-efficacy is a term, for those of you who didn't listen to a previous podcast, that indicates how much you believe you have whatever it takes to succeed in the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that life may put at you. And if you have high self-efficacy, that means you see life challenges as things you can overcome. And if you have low self-efficacy, it means you can't believe you can cope with what's going on. So because they have low self-efficacy, they often also have poor self-esteem, right? And perfectly reasonable, right? If you don't think you have the good coping skills, you're not going to feel very good about yourself, right? Most of these folks have little to no self-insight, even though they think they do. They're delusional, not clinically, but their common sense of the term delusional. They're mistaken seriously. They also don't have good insight into other people's behaviors and actions. They don't know what to do with that. And that's because they have inflexible and or concrete reasoning with usually pretty gross deficits in fluid abstract reasoning, also known as executive functioning, especially as it relates to cause and effect relationships for future behaviors. So in other words, they can't apply what that's a fancy way of saying is they can't apply common sense heuristics or rules of thumb to current situations so that they don't make the same mistakes in different scenarios in the future, right? They just can't do it. They're like the ADHD people. They have very poor abstract reasoning. That's one of the reasons why AA's and all the 12 steps in the disease model appeals to them, because it's a very, I'm not saying this to be mean, I'm really not. It's a very infantile, very moronic, very concrete reasoning type theory, right? They also use an incredible amount of what Albert Ellis and Aaron Beck, some of the fathers of cognitive behavioral therapy, would call cognitive distortions, or as Albert Ellis would say, they masturbate. They do a lot of masturbations. They have a lot of irrational belief systems. They adhere to a lot of misbeliefs about stuff, and then they try to find instances to validate their misbeliefs, and they don't even know they have the misbeliefs, and when you point it out to them, they want to argue about it. They often have self-identity issues or existential issues. They don't know who they are, what they represent, what their relationship to a higher power is, if they even believe in a higher power, what's the higher power look like, or God, or Allah, or Buddha, or whatever, or if they don't even know what they don't even make good atheists because they don't know enough about themselves to have any existential issues or to have any existential orientation. They can't. They don't know themselves, right? They often have very poor resiliency, right? So the least little thing sends them into the, as I call it, the prissy syndrome. And again, this is not a slam, it's a description. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, if you haven't listened to a previous podcast when I've used this term, prissy is the African-American chick on Gone with the Wind that goes, "Lord, I miss God, I don't remember my mother, no babies." Right, that's prissy syndrome, right? Histrionic, right? So they typically have very, very poor resiliency, and they just sort of collapse, and then they want to feel better right now. They don't want to wait for shit to feel better later, right? And they often are what I call developmentally fixated. They start using substances pretty early. In case most of you don't know, somebody who's going to become a quote-unquote addict in later life generally is in the mindset, in the process by around age 15. And think about all the neurological stuff that's going on in a developing brain, as well as all the developmental tasks that are going on, right? Existential allegiances and ideas and constructs, identity constructs, where you fit in at work, at home, how do you balance what you want with what your parents want, with what your peer group wants, with what school's demanding, how do you communicate with people, how do you conflict management, how do you task manage, time manage, money manage, social milieu stuff, how do you do social interactions other than drugs, right? Occupational stuff, what do you want to be when you grow up kind of stuff, right? They're developmentally fixated because their development has stopped because once you start using drugs, your entire, mindset is how to get the drug, use the drug, lie about the drug, get more of the drug, not get caught using the drug, not get caught buying the drug, operating under the influence of the drug or drugs, and then acting like you're not, So your developmental tasks are all substance-related. They're not life-related, okay? So these people become stuck, very much like a trauma, which is, again, and I mentioned this on a previous podcast, this is the thesis of my book, right? The Substances as Trauma Model book that I'm writing, because it is. It's like a trauma. If you look at the trauma research, these folks have a lot of the same stuff that trauma people have in the sense of being fixated or stuck at the age at which their quote-unquote trauma occurred. And I talk about addictions as a, and trauma is kind of a process. It's not one thing. It's a series of things. And at some point, the one thing, the defining event, as it's called in trauma literature, happens. And it's the proverbial traumatic event that breaks this trauma camel's back, right? But it's a process. And so once you get into the process of substances and you're into it, substances act like a trauma. They fixate your development. Okay. So obviously, if you have any of that kind of stuff, you're going to need a huge cadre of stuff to help folks. And what I tell people, you know, my approach is very non-traditional, non-12-step, non-disease model. I tell people that up front. So if they call in for services, most people know that they're not going to get the, you know, easy does it, one day at a time, once, you know, and they're not going to hear all those ridiculous platitudes. They're going to hear the real deal and what it's going to take to get clean and sober. But part of it, if that is their goal, not everybody comes in to me to get clean and sober. Some people just come in to manage the stuff. And while that's not my choice for them, you know, it's not my life. I don't have the right to dictate to them, you know, or you must be clean and sober. Obviously, they can't keep abusing the drug. But, you know, there's a pretty good bit of research. And again, this runs contrary to the disease model. But there's a lot of research out there that says, you know, there's about 45% of the folks who were previously diagnosed as meeting the criteria for substance dependency, being an addict, right, who can actually go back to recreational using and not relapse and not die like the 12-step says they're going to, right? We know that for a fact. We've known it for 20-something years, right? But I tell everybody, why risk it? You don't need the drugs to live, right? And and this is the analogy I use. I tell people, you know, if you're going in and you have just more money than brains and you're, you know, unhappy with the way your nose looks and you go into a plastic surgeon and you say to the plastic surgeon, Doc, I want you to fix my nose. And the doc looks at you and examines you and does some tests and says, you know what, here's the good news. You're going to look better than a GQ model or a, 17 model or a Vogue model or whatever. And I can make you look so great, everybody on the planet's going to want to, you know, do you, whether they're male, female, animal, vegetable, mineral, rock, or otherwise, right? But here's the bad news. There's about a 55-56% chance you won't survive the surgery, or you'll come out scarred looking a lot worse than you are right now. Okay, now this is optional surgery, guys and gals, right? Now, I ask you, do those sound like really good odds to you? That sounds dumber than dog poop to me, right? Oh, yeah, I'm going to go in there and get scarred up for the maybe the 40-something percent chance I'll come out looking better? I don't think so. Okay, I'll be a vampire. I'll break all the mirrors and not look at myself, right? Because vampires cast no reflection. You can tell what kind of movies I watch, right? So it's the same pattern for folks who have substance abuse and dependency issues, right? Particularly, you know, you're not going to, how do you know you fall in that 44 whatever percent? How do you know you're not in the 56%, right? You don't. Best option, abstinence. That's the one thing AA and I agree on. Abstinence is your best option, bar none. Right, it's just the smarter road to go. You don't need that stuff to live, right? And particularly if you have a bunch of comorbid disorders, particularly personality disorders, particularly ADHD, particularly if you have a history of failing, repeated attempts to moderate or quit or whatever, whether it's inpatient, outpatient, whatever, providing you've done it correctly. You know, particularly if you have a family history of it, particularly if you've been doing it for a long period of time, you're not going to fall in that 50-something percent. Just take my word for it, right? Just give it up. And, you know, go cold turkey, do whatever you got to do, but get in there and do that nasty four-letter word work and don't relapse, right? Now, of course, most people don't listen to me and they're like, because of all the aforementioned characteristics I mentioned. Oh, yeah, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Yeah, right. Okay. What does he know? He's never been drunk before, right? Well, I've never stuck my finger in an electric sock and poured water on myself, but I know what the hell will happen, okay? And it isn't good, okay? So first thing I do is I do a thorough assessment. I'm not going to go into all the details. Figure out what these folks are missing, and then I start a working on what it is they're going to do to get better, right? To remediate their deficits, to make up for the developmental stuff that they're missing. Right? Particularly if you've got people who have religious addiction issues, and there's plenty of them out there, and or have been abused through religious organizations, even those that are more normal, not the so-called cults, but the, you know, these guys and gals are not going to do well on a 12-step program. It's just ridiculous. You know, I think the whole thing is ridiculous, but it's really ridiculous for those folks, right? Or if you got a person who is genuinely an atheist or genuinely agnostic, they're not going to do well on this kind of thing, right? In general, I talk about, you know, here's the aspects of the disease concept that I think are ridiculous, and what I use is what I call the choice concept, right? And some of this I've gotten from Peel and Brodsky, by the way, which is a really good book, The Truth About Addiction and Recovery. if you haven't checked it out, it's really good. I really, really, really like it. So they talk about some of the stuff about the disease concept versus what they call the choice concept. So in the disease concept, you already know, I've read you a bunch of that stuff. So let me talk about what I call the rational concept or the choice concept or whatever you want to call it, right? So according to the model that I use, addictions are multifaceted. All addicts are not the same, guys and gals, any more than all women are the same, all African Americans are the same, all gay people are the same, all straight people. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? So because addictions are multifaceted, right, they require multifaceted type of treatment because they usually involve inappropriate ways of dealing with life issues, whatever they may be, right? Individuals must focus on their individual problems as well as their skills. You can use whatever skills they have to boost their stuff, right? People's experiences of their own self will vary, so you have to, basically you're taking the individual as an individual. Whatever negative self-defeating habits or thoughts they have, you got to examine them, and you got to replace them with something positive. You got to get them to accept complete and utter responsibility for themselves, because the reality is that's the truth, and I can prove it every darn day of the week. Even if you buy the disease model, which I don't, but even if you buy it, the disease model doesn't say you have to start using. It says you can't stop once you start. Okay, so it's not a brain disease. You don't have to. Don't even get me started. I think I've already waxed. Enough on this. While total abstinence is certainly the desired end goal for these folks, you got to reinforce any decrease or any sort of life-enhancing thing they're doing and praise them for that. And I don't mean, you know, jump up and down and throw them a party, but you know, you got to build up their self-esteem, self-efficacy. It's really, really important. So some of these folks aren't ready for abstinence. I wish they were, but they're just not, and that's the reality. You try to move them there, and you try to get them there, but you take what you can get early on, right? And therapy that you undertake should be done mainly on the issues of, you know, thinking deficits, poor life choices, poor decision-making stuff, right? And do remediation, psychoeducational stuff, right? Life educational stuff. Anything that's challenging to them, you want to teach them to break stuff down so that they can analyze what are the components of this situation where I made a mistake, so I can figure out how to problem solve, and then I can apply these steps to future situations that are the same or avoid situations that kind of look like, walk like, talk like, and smell like these kind of things, right? It's like one of the things I talk about with addicts is, you know, if you like, you know, a good Reuben, but the best Reuben is at Paul's Bar and Grill 2 blocks from your house, get your Reuben from someplace else. Not a good idea. Or get a buddy to go to Paul's and buy the Reuben for you and not bring you back a six-pack either, okay? Bad idea, right? One of the other things that AA does that I really admire, one of the few things they do that I admire, is they talk about avoiding people, places, and things and encourage you to use, right? That's called setting event and stimulus stuff. That's behavioral therapy. That's proven shit, okay? That's a different issue. That's not just esoteric-y whatevers. That's proven stuff, okay? Any supports you can do, right? Coaches, teachers, friends, religious figures, family members, you know, whatever. If you can go to AA and, you know, block out all the other horse manure, but use it as a social, you know, acceptance thing and a thing to get yourself, if you're spiritually oriented or existentially oriented and you're so, you know, compelled to do that kind of stuff in that kind of manner, great. No problem. If you use it for that, I have zero problem with it. Right? So, you know, people have to ultimately, though, take responsibility for their stuff. They cannot wait for God to do it. Again, you can ask God or whatever for help, but you don't want to be doing that kind of stuff on a permanent basis. One of the things I also do is I give people what I call a responsible thinking homework sheet that sort of help them. So I have a lot of structured exercises I give them. To take home, you know, and I tell every addictions person, and actually I tell everybody that walks into my office, you know, anybody just about can make a change, right? And to make a meaningful change, you need these 6 things. And this is true if you're losing weight, if you're quitting smoking, if you just want to be a nicer guy or gal, whatever, right? Number one, the ability. You got to have the ability to change, and most of us have that. Awareness, you have to recognize you need to change, that something's wrong. Motivation, you have to really want to make a change. right? Self-efficacy, there's that word again, believing that you have what it takes to change, or at least figuring out a way to you know, fool yourself till you do, right? Or helpfully to remediate that. And that's where most people fall short. They don't, even if folks are aware they need to change and they have the ability, if they don't believe that they have the ability, right, they're done, right? And I defer to Yoda in that one. Right. Those of you who know me know I'm a big Star Wars freak, and I'm a big movie freak in general. But I'm a big Star Wars freak because there are a lot of truths in Star Wars. And one of the things is Yoda, you know, when he says, you know, there is no do or do not. There's no try. I misquoted that. I'm sorry. There's no try. There's only do or do not. Right. And I'll tell you the same thing a buddy of mine said. Now, you guys have heard this before on previous podcasts. As you believe, so shall you do. And that is so true, right? So if you don't believe you can change, even if you have the ability, it's going to really be a difficult uphill battle, right? So part of my goal is to try to teach people to have self-efficacy, and that's a toughie. Number five is information. You got to know how to do it, because even if you have the other four stuff, if you have zero idea how to do it, you need somebody to teach you. This is where I come in, right? I tell everybody on the planet, I'm basically an overpaid teacher, right? And number six, you know, like the joke about the violinist walking around New York looking for Carnegie Hall, and he stops this other guy carrying a violin case and says, oh my gosh, another musician, I'm looking for Carnegie Hall. Can you tell me how to get to Carnegie Hall? And what does the guy carrying the violin case say? Practice, 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 right? Boom. Right, so not my joke. Okay, but I like it. So number six is practice, right? Another word for practice is work. Oh my God, there's that nasty four-letter word again. God, is he going to ever quit saying that? No. And you got to practice regularly and consistently, and effectively, and you got to do it till the cows come home, go back out, and come home again. Over-practice. Practice, 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 and over-practice. Work, 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 and overwork. Till this thing is so automatic, you can do it in your sleep. Okay? So there's a lot more to this than I've been able to say in a little over an hour. I mean, you got to manage your nutrition because, as I've said to folks before, you know, and as George Harrison so wisely said back in the late 60s on his song Savoy Truffle, you know that what you eat, you are, and what is sweet now is so sour. Right, so you got to get on a good nutritional health plan, vitamins, yada yada yada. And I'm really, really good about referring folks to nutritionists or dietitians if they need it. That's very, very important. So it's a multifaceted aspect. This is not a one simple one size fits all dilly. This is a very complicated set of exercises. So I hope all of you who feel about the 12 steps as I do have enjoyed this, and I hope all of you who like the 12 steps cut me off a lot earlier so that you wouldn't find yourself uberly pissed off by the midway of this podcast. Thanks very much for listening. I apologize for my over-the-topness on this, but I am just so damn sick of this model. I don't know what the hell to do. I'm so sick of people being stupid about it. I don't know what the hell to do, and I just had to say it. I couldn't stand it any longer. So again, thank you for indulging me. Forgive me if I insulted or if people felt insulted or upset for this work, this podcast, but you got warned early, so you only have yourself to blame if you didn't cut me off sooner. Thanks very much, and look for another podcast soon. Thanks again. I really, really appreciate it. Have a great day.